It's a great pleasure for me this evening to introduce the judge of this year's Creative Writing Awards contest, Canadian poet and fiction writer Keith Taylor, who will announce the various contest prize winners and then give us a reading from his own work. Born in British Columbia in 1952, Keith Taylor is a descendant of Western Canadian homesteaders of conservative Mennonite stock. Though he spent his childhood in Alberta and his adolescence in Indiana, it was his early love of books and travel that took him far from his cultural roots and prompted him to explore his Canadian heritage through his poetry and fiction. To support himself in his travels, he became, by necessity, a jack of many trades, earning his livelihood variously as a camp boy for a hunting outfitter in the Yukon, as a dishwasher in southern France, as a house painter in Indiana and Ireland, as a freight handler, as a teacher, as a freelance writer, and even as a night attendant at a pinball arcade in California. After several years of extensive travel in Europe and the British Isles, Keith moved to Michigan and earned his MA in English at Central Michigan University. In 1979, he moved to Ann Arbor, where he earned a good deal of his living as a very knowledgeable bookseller, first at Ulrich's, then at Borders Books, and then most recently as a manager at the Shaman Drum Bookshop. It is also in Ann Arbor that Keith has made his home with his wife Christine and their daughter Faith. As a manager at Shaman Drum, Keith has become well known for his thorough knowledge of the drum's wide selection of academic and scholarly titles, and he has been instrumental in getting thousands of books into the appreciative hands of those who want to buy them. As a dedicated educator, he has also taught part-time at Central Michigan University and also at the University of Michigan's Residential College. After 20 years of bookstore experience, Keith is no longer a bookseller who writes poetry and fiction on the side. Beginning this fall, he will serve as coordinator of the University of Michigan's undergraduate subconcentration in creative writing program, and in this capacity will be able to devote a greater portion of his time to his own writing, which has now become the center of his work life. At present, he is busily at work from morning until night, working on a five book-length projects, one of which is a translation of 15 poems by the modern Greek poet Kostas Kariotakis, who committed suicide in 1928. To date, Keith Taylor has published five collections of poetry: Learning to Dance, Weather Report, Dream of the Black Wolf, Detail from the Garden of Delights, and Everything I Need, and one collection of very short stories, Life Science. His poems, stories, book reviews, and feature articles have appeared in a variety of periodicals, including Caliban, The Alternative Press, Michigan Quarterly Review, Hanging Loose, Notice, Story, Pivot, Witness, Phoebe, and the Greenfield Review, and in such newspapers as the Detroit Free Press, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and the Ann Arbor Observer. In addition, he's very pleased that his essay, Emerson at Hellgate, was published in the first issue of the fourth genre, MSU's New Journal of Creative Nonfiction. He is currently at work with John Knott, co-editing an anthology of poems, stories, and essays entitled The Huron River, Voices from the Watershed, which touches upon the Huron River, which flows through Ann Arbor. The anthology will be published by the University of Michigan Press this summer. Among his many awards and honors, Keith Taylor has received a fellowship in poetry from the National Endowment for the Arts and has served as artist in residence at the Isle Royale National Park and as a writer in residence for fiction for the Writer's Voice at the Detroit YMCA. In 1997, he received a Creative Artist Grant for fiction from ArtServe Michigan, which was awarded in conjunction with the Michigan Council for the Arts and Cultural Affairs. In 1999, he was selected as one of the artists eligible to participate in the National Community Arts Residency Program, administered by the Mid-Atlantic Arts Foundation. As a poet, Keith Taylor is particularly interested in the literature of place, as distinguished from 19th century regionalism, and has found southeastern Michigan a rich terrain in which to explore place as both setting and subject. Fiction appeals to him as a way of looking at the world aslant and enables him to resolve through its possibilities many everyday experiences that often go unresolved. Short fiction in particular serves for him as a kind of photograph, an intricate cameo, or a cinematic freeze frame that can capture particular moments deserving of more delicate examination and understanding. Michigan poet Thomas Lynch, who has dedicated the title poem of his collection, Still Life in Milford, to Keith Taylor, has perceptively observed of Taylor's most recent collection of poems, Everything I Need, that, quote, once again, Keith Taylor adds wisdom to the common dialogue. These are poems of such generous and persistent witness of flora and fauna and his fellow humans. In the indispensable vernaculars of elegy and memoir, homage and grief, Mr. Taylor delivers his testimony, and we are swayed, if not towards comfort, then towards the truth. Of Taylor's short fiction, Charles Baxter has noted that sly, ghostly, and unsettling, Keith Taylor's prose pieces in Life Science are about the encounters between ourselves and what we glimpse through a crack in the world. There's something there, all right, something with fur and feathers, something shivery in a green hat, something waiting and watching. Even though it kept me awake part of the night with its eerie humor and visions, I loved this book. Please join me in extending a very warm welcome to Canadian poet and fiction writer Keith Taylor.
Oh, I don't know about you, but I could just sit there and listen to that all day. It's like, too bad my mother's dead. I could say, look, I amounted to something. I'm going to give out these awards first that I had the great pleasure of reading. It was a lot of fun to read them. And I'm going to give the little comments on these pieces that I wrote as I selected them. Arthur told me that the people who won don't know that they won. So I'll try to find some way to make them as uncomfortable for as long as possible. Just a word about these contests for those of you who don't win tonight. Doesn't mean that you should stop by any means. I want you to know that as an undergraduate, I never won any of these things, and I always considered the judges complete fools. And I give you permission to think the same thing of me. Anybody who does this knows that there's a very good chance they're going to make mistakes. Literature is bigger than most of our definitions of it. The one I had the least trouble with this year here was fiction. So I'm going to start with fiction. And I tell you what I'll do is I will read the title of the story, I'll give my little two-sentence comment on the story, and then I'll tell you the author. And if the author is here, that person has to come up here to get this envelope, in which there is no money, I've been told. There are forms that you have to fill out so you can get the money. So those, you know, you 11 people who are going to get these things, keep that in mind. You have to fill out these forms. So the third prize for the Jim Cash Creative Writing Award in fiction. I better get to the right page or I'll be giving the wrong things to the wrong person. Here we go. It was for a short story called The Silent Intersections. And there was another story that was built around the tensions in families, as this one was. Although this time the story is about a young woman coming to terms with her father's reticence. Now you're going to know. The author knows the importance of small things in the world. She writes with a detail that makes her situations completely believable. The Silent Intersections was written by Amy Hines. Is Amy Hines here? She doesn't get her money. Any of you know Amy Hines, let her know. Second place story. Was a story called Timing the Drips. This author has written a very funny story about families and growing up in one, yet beneath the surface is a kind of sadness about this particular family. He has a great ear for the nuances of speech, and how could I not give an award to a story that has this sentence in it? What privacy were family? This is Timing the Drips by Jacob Posner. It's Jacob Posner here. Doesn't get his money either. The first place story, this is the story I thought the best. It's a story called Debris. The author has a wonderful lyric style, uncluttered yet evocative, a good eye for our landscape, and the ability to find the words for what he sees. He's willing to let simple action stand on its own. After the first read of all the manuscripts for all these competitions, this was the single piece of writing that I remembered the most clearly. Usually a very good test. After you read a bunch of things, this, you know, which one do you remember? This was the one. It's a short story called Debris, and it's by Nathan Bloom or Blom. Is Nathan here?
He's not here.
Give Nathan his form, so he gets his money. And it's a wonderful story. But I think that this story, if I remember correctly, and some of you can correct me, I think the winners of this, the first place of the Jim Cash thing in poetry and fiction appear in the Red Cedar Review, right? So this story will appear in there. Okay, so that's Jim Cash fiction. I'm going to get back to Jim Cash poetry later. I'm going to jump ahead because I want to talk about poetry at the end. There's an award, the George B. Lawson Prize, for the best literary essay submitted. Now, the interesting thing about this is, what did they mean by literary essay? And of course, I didn't call up anybody to ask them because I wanted to have my own definitions. I suspect maybe, although I don't know, that literary essay was supposed to mean an essay about literature. I didn't read it that specifically. I'm fairly interested in the kinds of essays that, oh, say, would have been published in this new journal that's coming out of here, the fourth genre. And I think I consider those literary essays. They're essays in the belletristic tradition. So there were several pieces. There were a couple literary essays, and there were several pieces that seemed to me to be read as essays. And I might be wrong. The piece that I'm giving the essay award to may indeed have been written as a piece of fiction. So I realize that I might be imposing the wrong category on this piece of writing. But I chose to read it as a personal narrative, as a piece of creative nonfiction, although it certainly does use some of the devices of fiction. Dialogue and pacing would be things in mind. The writing was clear and forceful. The author treated his subject, the discovery and fear of gay love, candidly and with bravery. So this piece of writing, essay or not, which gets this George B. Lawson Prize, is called Heads Up, Seven Up, and it's by Matt Duke. Matt Duke is not here. Now, all the poets are here because I know that. So we'll move on to poetry. Now, the interesting thing about the poetry contest this year, there are three contests. The winner of one gets the most money. The winner of another is assured of publication. And the winner of the third, it's labeled the best poem at MSU this year. And it was like, man, I was thinking, any one of those things I'd go for, you know. And I didn't want to give the same prize have the same poem win all three prizes. That didn't seem quite right. And also, you know, I could juggle three poems that way. So there are three first place poems, which is odd. And you'll just have to figure out which is which. So I'm going to save the best poem at MSU till last. And let's see, we'll start with Assured Publication. So these are the poems. I'll start 3, 2, and 1 in the first place prize at Assured Publication, I was told, in the Red Cedar Review. I have to say, when I moved to Michigan in 1975, somewhere in there, and I mean, I never didn't live here, I didn't go to school here, but I was sending poems to every place, including the Red Cedar Review. And sometime around 1977 or 1978, the Red Cedar Review published a little poem of mine called The House Painter's Recreation, which I've never reprinted anywhere else. But I really felt like I'd made it. You know, I was this magazine at MSU published this poem of mine. So, you know, Red Cedar Review, this is a big deal, or at least it is for some of us. Okay, so the Jim Cash Creative Writing Award in Poetry. The third one. This was a long poem called I. It's a long and extremely ambitious poem that I admired even when I felt it didn't quite come together for me in the end. The author moves through several languages trying to find a way to believe in the emotions behind or beneath the words. It's a very intellectually ambitious poem. I admired it. The poem is called I, and I'm going to butcher the author's name, Marija Nesevich. Is she here? The poets are not all here. She goes in that pile. The second poem. This is the second place poem in the Jim Cash Award. It's a poem called Strain. a quiet and frightening poem about urban life, the sounds and images combined to convince this reader, anyway, of the inevitable tragedy suggested at the end. The poem was called Strain, and it's by Jennifer Gage. We have somebody here, all right. Good, I get to shake somebody's hand. Congratulations, there you go. So the first place poem, and this is the one that's assured publication, right, of the Jim Cash Creative Writing Award. This was a poem called Water Signs. This poem is exceptionally polished without feeling forced. It really feels as if this poem could be published anywhere. I mean, it feels as if there's not a whole lot of work to do on it. It's eminently publishable. The poet controls a remarkable set of lush images that are linked together masterfully. In some ways, it reminded me of some of Neruda's longer love poems. So the poem is called Water Signs, and the poet is Meg McClure. She's in Italy. She doesn't need the money. But she does need the publication. Okay, now I'm going to go on to the Gordon and Catherine Swarthout Literary Prize. This changes year to year from fiction to poetry. So this year, this was, for poetry, the first place prize in this contest is the one that got the most money. So I'm going to start at number three again and move up. The third place poem is a poem called Cedar Drowning. This is a small poem, very, very tiny, almost tiny poem, that plays with sounds in the position of words on the page. It creates small moments of joy that seem to contain ominous suggestions about things to come. Cedar Drowning by Catherine Preston. No Catherine Preston. Nobody knows her. Good poem, though. When you read it. Second place poem called Estate. And even though I think there are a few things in this poem that still need some work, particularly in the first stanza didn't quite grab me like the rest of the poem did. Estate is already a memorable catalog of one small life. The poet has done a very good job selecting the details that define the biography without ever entering his own comments. And Estate was written by Ryan Bose. And he's all the way in the back. All right. Good job, Max. Okay, the first place poem of the Swarthout Literary Prize, which gets the most money. This is a poem called To the Stomping Ground. This poet has written a quiet narrative poem that combines the story of a father-daughter relationship with rural and natural images. I have to admit, I'm a sucker for country poems, so. Listen to all she gets in the first four lines. My father led me to East Pasture, his weekend daughter tiptoeing around cow dung. To the Stomping Ground, and it's by Carrie J. Preston. She has a class. Well, I'm glad we had two. Now, I have one more, and this is the one which the prize, it's not quite as much money, although it's not a lot less than the other one, but this is supposed to be the best poem at MSU this term, in my humble opinion, or at least of the poems I read. The rest of you didn't send me poems. This is a poem, and I'm going to butcher the title, Phalaenopsis. It's a wonderfully ambitious poem that attempts to bring together history, personal history, and observation of the natural world. This poet has achieved a remarkable success in a comparatively small space. She does all this on one page. Great work. Title is Phalaenopsis, and the author is Josefina Diaz. There you go. You wrote the best poem. And that's your pile. Okay. So that's a lot of fun. We all go downhill from now. No, we don't. We don't. When I do these things, I try to unify them around a theme, usually. But my theme tonight, this February, just seems to be cabin fever. I kind of wish I love living in Michigan, I mean, I'm a transplant here, but I love living here. This February, I don't. I wish I was somewhere else. So I thought I would read poems that take me around the world and do different things, or short prose pieces. And one piece that's kind of long about Paris, because isn't it nice to think about Paris or Italy? I thought I would start, though, with one piece that's southeastern Michigan, this book that Arthur was talking about that I just did on the Huron River. I took a bunch of pieces that the Huron River flows in a big semicircle. Starts up by Pontiac and comes around through Ann Arbor and goes out to Lake Erie. There'd be no need for an anthology of literature written in that watershed if that river did not flow through Ann Arbor, where there's a university press that likes to publish books. But it does, so we put together this anthology. I wrote little connector pieces that went from the beginning, the springs, up by Pontiac, all the way to the mouth at Lake Erie. This is one of the little ones, a place right by Ann Arbor. It's called Black Ice. Some things shouldn't frighten me. I should know better. If given half a chance at a party or over drinks, I'll bore my friends with stories of ice skating across prairie sloughs 40 years ago, learning how to turn quickly and handle a puck. Yet when my 7-year-old daughter and I drive down by the Huron after a 2-week cold snap and find the large pond behind Barton Dam completely frozen and carrying several families of skaters, I feel the flutter of my new and overeducated fear. Of course, I let her go out on the ice. I go with her. We stare down through several inches of black ice at the plants drifting in the slight current. We hope to see a cold fish swim by. She kicks a stone across the ice, squealing with pleasure at its speed and distance. She wants to kick it all the way across, over to the marina below the rich people's homes. That's when I get scared. I call her back and climb out on the dike above the water. She keeps kicking her stone across the ice, and I notice pressure cracks. I begin to imagine the groans and cracks of ice. Come on, Faith, we have to go, I call out, and she ignores me as she's done for most of her life. I keep calling, and she still ignores me, kicking her rock across the frozen river, sliding on her feet, her knees, even her butt, laughing and laughing. I call again, more urgently, and then again. I try to sound tough and threaten loss of privileges. She kicks the rock out farther and keeps going. So we'll start in Michigan in winter, and let me first of all move just a little further north, quite a ways further north, actually. Up to Isle Royale, where I've been fortunate enough to spend some time. They're doing a big anthology of work from the Artists in Residence program, so I've been reading galleys on this stuff lately, and I said, ooh, I kind of like this. And I hadn't read these poems anywhere in 2 or 3 years. So here's Isle Royale when you plan your summer getaway. If you haven't been there, I recommend it, although it's some work. I did a little chapbook of things that I wrote when I was at Isle Royale, and I varied prose and poetry. So what I'm going to read is this tiny little section of prose that's followed, in my mind anyway, by the poem that comes after. And I think you can even tell a difference between the prose rhythms and the verse rhythms, but maybe not. I'm here, looking out the front window of the cabin they've provided for me, Tobin Harbor, Isle Royale, Lake Superior. The only sound other than bird call and the occasional outboard is the high ringing of my own blood in my ears. A family of mergansers has been playing in the calm water of the passage between this window and the little island 50 or 60 yards offshore. A loon floats through but doesn't sing. A black duck dabbles past, its bill almost phosphorescent, greenish yellow. 2 spotted sandpipers fly by. Chipping sparrows are nesting in the spruce not 15 feet from the front door of this place. A late wild iris has bloomed in the 4 hours since I arrived. 2 hours ago, it was still wrapped around itself. The Guest Cabin for Elizabeth Kemmer. Blue burns in a blue world. Wild iris, the blue flag uncurled in a basalt crack below spruce and beard moss. A greeting, if we want it, from the woman long dead who built her place where the wail and tremolo of loon song collect like the vespers chants of monks moving to prayer. The sun at evening prisms through their window, dappling the altar red and blue. I knew I was missing something. So the end of that poem, that rather obvious and perhaps too obvious connection of the natural world with the temple, the church. La nature est un temple, Baudelaire said. Has always bothered me a little bit, although I've decided recently that I liked it more than I thought I did. Here I tried a similar idea, although without being so obvious. It gets us a little further north and a little further west up in the Yukon. Most of the sections are up in the Yukon, although the first section starts out in Alberta. I've had the great good fortune of my life, and it continues, of having close relationships with bears. I see bears more easily than other people do. I don't know why. This is called Bear Stories. It's in prose. It's in five sections. Bear Stories. One, Stanley Stewart's aunt read about it in the Calgary paper. A tourist from the States wanted to take his daughter's picture with the black bears at Banff. He coated her hands with honey. He stepped back. The child reached toward the bears like her father told her to do, and he snapped a picture of a bear eating his daughter's hands. Two. Never run from a grizzly, old John told me. They'll beat you every time. You can try to climb a tree, but any tree you can climb, a grizzly can too. He'll just walk up it like a ladder. No, the best thing to do is just stand there and try to get up a big gob of spit in your mouth. Just before a grizzly gets you, he'll stand on his back legs and roar. This is your only chance. When he roars, take that gob of spit and spit it right into his mouth. If you get it back against his throat, he'll turn around and take off. It works better if you're chewing tobacco. Three. Laverne told how his first grizzly charged after the first shot. Since a grizzly's eyes are bad, Laverne figured she was going for the smell of gunpowder. She came 100 yards straight for him, Laverne shooting the whole time. The bear dropped 10 feet from his blind. When he gutted her, he found 5 of his bullets in her heart. Four. John and I came back to the main camp after a few days cutting horse trail and found our cook tent ripped to ribbons, the table torn apart, even the stove knocked on its side. A few minutes later, I saw the outline of a black bear sitting in the brush at the edge of our clearing. He must have been accustomed to people, maybe to dumps at mining camps or to other hunting outfits. John gave me the rifle, a small boar goat gun, but the only one we had at the time, your first bear, he said. I tried to aim behind the front leg. I squeezed off the shot slowly like I'd been told, and the bear howled like a baby, or maybe more like a rabbit that's just been snatched by an owl. He took off through the woods, breaking branches and tearing up bushes. We waited a few hours, hoping the wound would stiffen him up, then followed the blood spots through the forest. About 0.5 mile from camp, we found where he'd holed up, the ferns pressed down and covered in blood, but the bear was gone. The blood trail gave out soon after. Five. It was a Sunday. I took my lunch and binoculars, but no gun. I followed a stream up the mountain behind camp until I reached the spring that fed it. Then I crossed a couple of ridges and moved up through the last scrub firs at the tree line. I kept climbing. The only things growing up there were small mountain blueberries. They were ripe and close to the ground. I knelt down and ate them, picking each berry carefully and wiping off the dust of the mountain. I continued climbing until I reached the last high ridge. I sat there, ate my lunch, and looked out over the hills and forest below me. I knew our camp was somewhere down there on the edge of the lake, but I couldn't see it. The lake went off to the east for many miles. I could just make out the small valley where it emptied and where the Yukon River started. I pulled my hat over my eyes, lay back in the blueberries, and slept. As soon as I woke up, I sensed I was not alone and might be in trouble. I raised my hat, then my head, slowly. Below me, back down the mountain, maybe 150 yards, but well up from the tree line, a lone grizzly was working his way across the mountain. The fur on his hump caught the sun and seemed almost golden. He looked larger than any animal I had ever seen, bigger than a moose, much stronger than the workhorses on my grandfather's farm. He was raking his claws through the blueberries, pulling out large clumps of them, roots, leaves, dirt, and stuffing everything into his mouth. I could see his teeth even without binoculars. The breeze was blowing up the mountain from the lake, but I still tried not to breathe. The bear didn't turn, didn't look up, just buried his way below me for 0.5 hour. After he disappeared around a far ridge, I lay half afraid and without moving at least 1 hour longer. That's the peace of mind that goes over best in my daughter's third grade class. They just love to hear about those bears. And I like it too. Before I cross, or in the process of crossing oceans and going to more exotic places, let me read you a poem. This is verse, very short-lined verse, also in several sections, about the way I got around for most of a decade when I was getting around. It's called Hitchhiking. One, nostalgia. I don't do it anymore. I hope my daughter never does it. It's dangerous, I know. I've read all about it in the papers. But there was once upon a time between 16 and 25 when I had no money, a world to see, and I'd stick my thumb out on any road anywhere and take off sooner or later to parts unknown and to places where I would find nothing but fun. Two, Moose Jaw. I stood beside the bypass past Moose Jaw one June day and night for 19 good hours and 19 cars passed me. None stopped. I played games with myself. Okay, company out there. If a car doesn't stop in the next hour, I'll bury a dime. And I did it. If I'm still here in 2 hours, I'll tie my shoelace. And I did it. Three, White Horse. Hours from the bush, my left foot wrapped in bandages, softly throbbing from an axe wound, I sat on my battered suitcase, filled with dirty socks, underwear, and too many books, the Alcan Highway sending up its dust all over me. 1,500 miles to Edmonton, then 2,000 more to Chicago. I could do it in a week. I waited hours, but no long-haul truck drivers stopped, no camper, no forestry man. I limped back to the bus station, spent half my funds for an easy ticket heading somewhere down south. Chateauroux. It was Sunday. I remember that. But I did not see a red castle or stream or anything else of interest. The sun was out and I began to feel warmer, the Provençal touch, even though I wasn't halfway to the sea. I didn't speak one single word of the language, had a couple of friends down in Toulouse who thought I might show up sometime, although they weren't certain. I was lonely, of course, but I was as happy then for 10 short minutes as I've ever been, beside a highway, southbound, my thumb out, broke, no one to love anywhere close, and nothing to do, no one to disappoint. Five, Mount Pleasant to Mishawaka. It was the last trip, a straight shot 200 miles south in July. I had the chance to see John, who'd moved west years before, married, calmed down, cleaned up, started a small company that's fixed foreign cars. It should have been easy, a lark. I hadn't figured on Grand Rapids, a city that's always bigger than it should be. I was stranded for hours downtown on an exit ramp off US 131. I didn't cross the Indiana line till midnight, saw John and his wife for 2 hours before they headed back west. A loss, but they divorced 6 months later, and I never again found the gumption to hitch. Six, What I've Become. On the first night of snow, I drive past a person standing beside the freeway, hunched over against the wind, one thumb stuck out. His car broke down. He's wearing a suit and tie, a long, fashionable black coat. The fear of hitchhiking has moved in so deep, I don't stop. I don't even think about it. Just write six-section poems about it. I'm going to read a long-ish story. I think it takes about 15 minutes. The nice thing about a story like this is you can feel free to fade in and come back, you know, when I get to the cussing and the sex and things. It's when you're at a poetry reading and somebody's reading these intense lyric poems, I always feel bad when I fade out. And of course I do, everybody does, right? It's like, oh, that poem, I missed it, and that was the poem that was going to change my life, or at least make my week. But with a short story, you know, you can just come and go. And that's kind of nice. Some of you have probably had this experience of what you write. Usually, you know, we think what we write is great, and then 5 years later we're embarrassed by it. That's the usual pattern. Now, this is a story I wrote quite a while ago, and I didn't like it. And I didn't like it because there are two rather sleazy characters in here, one of whom very closely resembles me in an earlier incarnation. And you know, I sort of didn't like that I did that to myself. But, you know, finally I sort of, somebody asked for stories and I sent them a story and they liked it. And then somebody read it and said, read this to my class, and I did, and the class liked it, and I said, oh, I kind of like it. So even though it's sleazy. So it's not an X-rated story, but it's definitely R. And you can come back, you know, when the R parts come in. You'll know what they are, I'm sure. Paris in the early 70s, by the way, is what it is. So the story is called After the Exhibition. It had been an exhibition a kid might have enjoyed, 12 years of contemporary art in France, 1960 to 1972. There wasn't any particular theme or style to it. I think the artists just wanted to show that they had recovered from the American influences of the 50s and that they were launching out in new directions. There were many pieces where the observer became a part of the composition, moved things, touched them, crawled around in them. Each piece could be as many pieces as there were people to see it. The one I enjoyed the most was a long tunnel divided into five sections. Each section was made of a screen that allowed in only one primary color. As I moved from red to blue to yellow, I felt the change in color physically as a buzzing around the edges of my eyes and a gentle nausea in the pit of my stomach. It was like a rapid change in the weather or in the barometric pressure. I spent most of the few francs I had left getting into the Grand Palais to see the show. I was always a bit nervous when I ran out of money, but had come to expect that help would arrive when I needed it. Someone would visit me from the States, and particularly if they came to Paris before they went anywhere else in Europe, I could count on several days of food in exchange for space on the floor of my room. One of my few acquaintances in the city might give me a loan. The $100 a month my father sent me might arrive early. Occasionally, I miscalculated and went hungry. A couple of months earlier, I'd gone 2 weeks with only one glass of powdered milk and a sugar cube once a day. It had been uncomfortable, and I'd spent a lot of time in bed reading Baudelaire very slowly. But it was bearable. I wasn't afraid of being broke. When I left the exhibition, I decided to spend the rest of my money on a beer in one of the overpriced cafes at the bottom of the Champs-Élysées. I wanted to sit quietly for a while, thinking about the show and reading through the explanations of their work that several of the artists had distributed. After a few minutes, just as I was getting comfortable and was beginning to see a pattern in all the images, an American man with a little girl sat at the table next to me. I did what I usually did in those situations. I ignored them and acted as if I couldn't understand what they were saying. The man, dressed casually but very fashionably, was blonde and looked to be in his mid-30s. He seemed genuinely embarrassed by his lack of French. The girl was only 9 or 10, but still wanted coffee. They were trying to communicate to the waiter that she didn't want café au lait, but wanted lots of milk on the side. I don't know why I did it. It was certainly not the kind of thing I usually did, but I decided to help. "Can I translate for you?" I asked. "Thanks," the blonde man said and looked relieved. When the little girl heard me speak English, she broke into a big smile. I told the waiter to bring some espresso in a very large cup with steamed milk in a pitcher. I told the girl that they made their coffee very strong here and she should use much more milk than she ever did at home. After she'd mixed the two, she said it was the best coffee she'd ever tasted. The man asked me to join them. With very little prodding, he began a quick summary of his life, even providing details of some intimacy. I'd been away from the States just long enough to have forgotten this easy kind of self-disclosure. I was even a bit embarrassed by it. His name was Paul, the little girl's Karen. He was a lawyer in Miami. He was divorced, and his wife had custody of their daughter. He got Karen for a 2-week vacation every summer and spoiled her rotten, taking her wherever in the world she wanted to go. This year it was Paris. They hadn't made any plans, but had just come on the spur of the moment as quickly as their travel agent could make arrangements. Karen sat and giggled through the whole story. I realized while Paul was talking that I'd begun to miss the particularly American mixture of brashness and sentimentality. At home, it got on my nerves. Its implied intimacy had made me angry occasionally, but now I found it refreshing. Much to my surprise, I liked Paul. When he offered to buy me another beer and sandwich, I accepted. Paul and Karen tried to pry my story from me. Although I kept some details hidden, I was comfortable enough telling them about my life in France, my studies, my friends. "You really live here?" the little girl asked. "Just a mile or so over there," I said, waving vaguely toward the northeast. "Can we come visit you?" "Oh, my place is pretty messy," I said, "and I live in a tough neighborhood." "We don't get scared," Karen said. "We're from Miami." Oddly enough, I felt somehow inhospitable, as if after accepting a beer from them, I had to show them my room, the unmade bed, the breadcrumbs, the piles of books. When Karen left to inspect the flowers planted in carefully maintained straight lines beside the street, I leaned over to Paul. "I live in a quarter called Saint-Denis," I said softly to him. "It's a low-rent, red-light district. It might be hard to explain all those half-naked women to her." "Yeah," he laughed, "you're right, it would." But Paul's expression changed quickly. He looked serious and excited. He leaned toward me and whispered, "That's not the place called Pig Alley, is it?" I must have looked blank. "My father was here in the war," he continued. "He told me about this place, Pig Alley. He said it had the best-looking whores in the world. Christ, he still talks about it." It had taken me a couple of minutes to figure out the GI lingo, and when I did, I laughed. "Oh, you must mean the Place Pigalle." "It's still here?" Paul asked. "The whores are still there?" "Not the same ones, I hope. But yeah, it's still here, bigger and better than ever." I was feeling good now, like the knowledgeable tour guide to the underside of the city. God, I'd love to see it. I'd love to be able to tell my father about it. He'd get a real kick out of it. "I could take you," I said, before I realized what I was doing. I must have been carried away with my own sense of my knowledge about the place, by the free beer, or maybe just by the conversation in English. It was not the kind of offer I usually made. "Really? God, that would be great." "But that's another tough part of town," I said, thinking Paul might want to head out there immediately. His daughter was running back toward us, carrying a marigold she'd picked. I was sure there must be some kind of fine for picking the city's flowers, and looked around quickly for a gendarme. "We wouldn't want to take Karen out there." "God, no," he laughed. "I can get a babysitter for her at the hotel. They provide that kind of service." Without mentioning where we were going in front of Karen, we made our plans for the evening. "I want to go too," she said. "No, honey, it's going to be late. We're going to do an adult thing," Paul said, and then looked at me and winked. "I'll bet the babysitter will have lots of fun things for you to do." He gave me the name and address of his hotel. It was one of the famous expensive ones, with uniformed doormen and high, ornate entrances that I'd walked by but hadn't imagined I would ever find a reason to enter. I said I'd pick him up around 9. He said the evening would be on him. I left while Karen was still looking cranky, but before she had a chance to start complaining.